Welcome to the Bregman Leadership Podcast. I'm Peter Bregman, CEO of Bregman Partners. We help companies achieve ambitious goals by strengthening leadership throughout the organization. I created this podcast to share ideas that you can use to become a more powerful and courageous leader. Hi, folks. I am here today, lucky enough to be here today with Gillian Tett. She's the U.S. Managing Editor and Columnist at the Financial Times. She's an anthropologist by training and a journalist by training and profession as well, and has written a fascinating book called The Silo Effect, The Peril of Expertise, and The Promise of Breaking Down Barriers. I see silos, as I'm sure you do, all the time in organizations. To have the perspective of both an anthropologist and a journalist is super interesting. And I would also say that understanding this as a cultural phenomenon in organizations is really interesting. So we're going to hear a little bit more about that. Welcome, Gillian.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. I'm excited to be here.
So you start out with this fantastic question. It's in the very first paragraph of your book. Why do humans working in modern institutions collectively act in ways that sometimes seem stupid? And I love it. I think it's funny. It's clear. It's also a little sad, and we all see it. And you talk about this sort of essential problem of fragmentation and the irony that we're more connected than ever, and at the same time, in some ways, we're more separated and broken into these silos. Can you share, just for a couple of minutes to start off, with the big idea of the book and kind of what drove you to write it and what you're seeing?
Well, the big idea of the book is that there is this horrible paradox which hangs over all of us in the 21st century, which is that we have these cell phones, our internet connections, our airplanes, our supply chains that give us the illusion that we live in a world which is hyper-connected. And yet when you look around at your life and the lives of people you know, you realize that in fact we are incredibly fragmented too, and in ways we often don't think about. And that carries a great cost. It makes us blind to risks, as we've seen many times in big companies that have done some very stupid things because of this problem of fragmentation. But it also makes us blind to opportunities. We miss some really exciting innovations or just ways to live more creatively and more effectively because we are completely shaped by what I call tunnel vision, sort of mental silos, and tribalism.
And, you know, you consider this less a psychological problem than a cultural problem. It's an organizational issue. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, psychology is definitely at the core of how we, each of us see the world around us and divide it up into boxes or silos, whatever label you want to put onto it. But I'm actually trained as a cultural anthropologist, and I think that there are enough people in the wider world who realize the value of anthropology. In recent years, we've learned all about the value of economics in wider policymaking decisions, and we know all about psychology these days as well. But anthropology, which is really the study of culture or the cultural maps and the cultural rules that we all inherit without thinking from our environment, I think anthropology can tell us a lot about silos because silos arise out of the classification systems that we use to organize and arrange the world around us. We're all hardwired to arrange the world into mental and social boxes just to cope with the amount of stuff we have to deal with. And those kind of cultural systems for classifying the world are ones that we tend to inherit almost unthinkingly from our families, from our society, from our company. But they have an incredibly powerful effect on what we do and can be very, very limiting if we don't actually, first of all, notice them and secondly, try to challenge them.
You know, it reminds me of this situation I was in a few years ago when I walked into an organization that I was working with, and it was an organization that was growing very, very rapidly. So by the time I was making this comment, in the last probably couple of years, maybe 75% of the people in the organization were new to the organization. And everybody was complaining about the cultural norms of the organization. And I said to the CEO, you know, 3/4 of this organization has no history of cultural norms. They're completely new to the organization. How is it, and I'm asking you this question, how is it that even when you have 75% of the people who are new, they and complaining about the sort of deficit in the culture, that somehow they all begin to comply to what the sort of 25% was doing in the first place.
Well, cultural norms are very very powerful. We all inherit cultural maps from our surroundings. We're all creatures of our cultural environment, if you like, because we tend not to think about the unspoken norms that we inherit. I write in my book about an anthropologist called Pierre Bourdieu, who said the most powerful forms of ideological effect are those which need nothing more than a complicit silence. That sounds like a very long French sentence. But what it basically means is that the things we don't talk about, the social silences, are often as important as the things we do talk about. And when you have an organization, even if it's growing rapidly, when you have an organization that's got strong cultural norms, new people tend to be sucked into the same cultural map without even realizing it if they're not careful.
So how, this is the sort of million-dollar question, right? It's a question that everybody talks about in terms of organizational leaders saying, I want to change my culture. How do I change my culture? How do I make it more of a, you know, an achievement-driven culture? Or I want people to take initiative, or I want them to break down silos. How do you begin to shift a culture? You have great stories in your book, some of which, you know, describe people who really tried to change cultures, who had their perspective in the right place, who knew what they were trying to do in terms of breaking down silos and creating a more collaborative culture, and yet they failed. And then others who succeeded. I'm wondering kind of what you learned in this research in terms of how do we break out of silos when we see them?
Well, what I learned is really two or three things. Firstly, that we don't have to be blindly mastered by our silos. We can master them. And, you know, there are things that any person can do to try and deal with this problem of fragmentation. And a lot of that just starts in your head by recognizing the problems there and trying to think about alternatives. The good news is that any organizational structure or profession which is riddled with silos doesn't just create a problem. It creates a huge opportunity. And people who can jump across boundaries mentally or structurally or socially often do some amazing things in terms of innovation and look like geniuses just because they can think outside the box and think between the boxes. So in my book I give some examples of people who've been wildly innovative by jumping across the boundaries. I talk about a hedge fund that's taken advantage of the big bank's silos to essentially make a lot of money by trading some of the really weird distortions that happen because banks are so marred by rigid silos. I look at the Chicago Police Department, which has done some really innovative things in terms of trying to combat the problem of murder, again, just by breaking down silos, or rather some individuals breaking down silos. So there are things you can do. And in the book, I lay out a whole series of ways that different companies and individuals have tried to break out of that trap of being mastered by their silos and just rethink the world in a new way.
So let's unpack it a tiny bit, because I think of the bank example as a really great example of a way to take advantage of other people's silos, but not necessarily breaking down the silos, but and I may have this wrong, but seeing an opportunity based in the fact that other people are operating in silos. And in the police force example, and again, I may have read this too quickly, but I see that as a really good example of breaking down the silo of information sharing. And I want to put the bar one step higher, which is to create a culture of collaboration where it's not just necessarily about sharing information or one person getting information from a lot of different departments, but really, you know, what Sony was trying to do, right, back in the 90s that they didn't succeed in doing, which is to really get different parts of the organization working more effectively together collaboratively. Do you have examples of that? And how do you, if you're a leader, begin to instigate that kind of collaboration?
Well, if you're a leader, there are a number of things you can do. You can make it clear to your employees that you welcome and support any attempts to break down silos and think outside the box inside your organization. You can think about the pay structure and think, well, is the pay structure incentivizing people to stay in very rigid silos and not collaborate with each other? I mean, banks are typical of this problem because they have what's called an eat what you kill payment system on Wall Street, where people get incentivized to just do their own trades Medicine is very similar in America in terms of doctors essentially being paid fees per service, not being incentivized financially to collaborate at all. You can try and do a mental experiment and try and turn up the structure of your organization upside down in your mind and say, well, if I was going to base this organization around the needs of consumers or a problem that I'm trying to solve, would I organize the departments in this way or not? Sounds abstract, but that's precisely what a big hospital that I write about called Cleveland Clinic did. You can try and shuffle people around. I mean, Facebook is a very interesting example in terms of what it's done internally, because it goes to enormous lengths to try and, one, recognize that it needs dedicated specialist project teams to write code. I mean, because you can't have 4,000 engineers all trying to write the same code. But it also tries to make sure that those different project teams don't become totally tribal and end up fighting with each other. And it has a whole series of internal management policies to try and prevent that, rotating people, forcing them to work with different teams, ensuring that they have a common cohort, contacts and social dynamic, if you like, because everyone who joins at the same time has to go on the same joint training course. So there are things you can do about silos, and as a leader, you break them down. But the one other thing I'd really point to as well is that if you are a leader who wants to try and challenge the problems of silos, you need to be able to accept or tolerate a little bit of slack in your organization. Most of the techniques that I outline in the book for trying to break down silos require some resources. And one of the biggest curses of the modern world is that in the name of efficiency and accountability and cutting budgets and austerity, most organizations, large organizations, when they become more, quote, efficient, essentially streamline to a point where they create these very deep silos that just don't talk to each other.
What you're saying right now is so interesting. It's this idea that efficiency actually reinforces and creates silos, because by definition, collaboration has embedded in it a waste, not a waste, a waste is the wrong word, but an absorption of time and resources. If you're going to sit a bunch of people in a room and you're going to talk to each other, that is less efficient than getting sitting down and doing a bunch of work. And yet, short term, it's less efficient, but long term, it creates an organization that moves holistically together.
Absolutely. I mean, so often large companies announce for the sake of efficiency and cost saving that they're going to streamline all the different departments. And when that happens, you know, really two important consequences emerge. Firstly, people inside departments are essentially incentivized just to chase what's beneath their noses. In quite a rigid formulaic way. They're often required to produce quick results for what they're doing, which requires sticking to your own speciality, swimming in your lane, to use jargon. But secondly, if you start over-streamline an organization, you cut out the people who are the natural silo busters and the people who are connectors and the people who actually have time to go between different departments trying to explain to one people what another people are doing. And losing both of those, as you say, can make an organization seem more efficient in the short term, but have disastrous long-term consequences.
So there's an image that I'm getting much more clearly from this conversation, even about the organizational structural response to silos is almost necessary, as opposed to the single person that says, I'm going to break down the silo. That on the one hand, you can have that example, but an example like Facebook, where they've specifically engineered the workspace. I remember when I was at Facebook, to see Mark Zuckerberg's office is literally it's like an aquarium. It's a glass box that he's inside. You can see everything that's going on. And the idea that there's no real walls in those buildings at all, that ultimately, you know, except what has to hold the roof up, that ultimately everybody's kind of in the space, able to see each other, connect with each other, that is from the ground up an organization that's built to not have silos, not just break them down. And then you have the other side, which is an individual. You have this beautiful image at the beginning of the book also of all these people standing around a dance floor, the men, unmarriageable and not willing to dance because there's some invisible wall. That's sort of what a culture is sometimes, right? An invisible wall that determines what you can do and can't do, and people aren't breaking it. And I'm just wondering if you personally, as an individual, are seeing that invisible wall, if you have the awareness, maybe you're coming at it as a consultant and you're on the outside and you can see the walls that other people can't see, or you're on the inside and you see that invisible wall. Any tip or trick to try to make that wall visible to the people around you?
I'm a huge fan of looking at the world of anthropology, and that's partly because I spent years of my life in that field. And I'm very committed to trying to show people outside, you know, what its value can be. I mean, my book on one level, The Job Creation Scheme for Anthropologists. But more importantly, you know, I happen to think that although the people sometimes think that what defines anthropology is its subject matter, that anthropologists go off and study far-flung societies and things, and that isn't really true these days. What defines anthropology is not so much where they do their study, because anthropologists study the Western world a lot now too. It's more a methodology, and it's about taking a bottom-up perspective on the world, using your eyes, wearing out your shoe leather to actually look, not just pontificate from an office. It's about looking at all the different parts of a society together and trying to look at the gap between rhetoric and reality, what people say and what they do, looking at the social silences. But above all else, what anthropologists do is they tend to go from society to society and compare, because they know that the best way to try and understand a society, including your own, is to really look at it as an insider-outsider, to have some sense of knowledge of what's going on, but also the detachment to be able to look at your surroundings with a set of context and perspective. And one way to do that is to walk in someone else's shoes or study another society for a period of time. So I would say to every company executive and employee that if you want to start thinking about silos effectively and looking at ways to break it down, try and adopt the insider-outsider perspective of an anthropologist and look at yourself and say, well, if I was a Martian and I'd landed in my company or in my environment for the first time, what would I see? And would I see a company that was seamlessly integrated, where everyone was thinking outside the box and letting their mind run roam? Would they see a place that's marred by tribalism and tunnel vision of a sort that people often don't notice? And if that second conclusion is correct, the question is then what do you do about it? And trying to imagine alternatives is a good place to start, and that's where anthropology can really help.
It almost seems like that should be the role of every senior leader in the organization, is to be separate enough, you know, involved enough, but also separate enough that they can see that, and tasked with the sort of obligation, the opportunity of looking for where there's lost opportunity by people not talking to each other, and find that and highlight it. And they often will have the power to maybe say something, and that saying something can have the power to do something.
Well, absolutely. That's the ideal. I happen to think also one could hire a bunch of anthropologists. And actually, I would say that, wouldn't I? But these days, actually, a number of companies are hiring anthropologists. I mean, there's growing demand for them from all kinds of companies, tech companies, consumer goods companies, traditional manufacturing companies too, precisely for this reason, that there's value in being an insider outsider. And, I mean, the key point in my book is to make this point that, you know, the problem with silos can't be solved by simply saying, let's abolish silos. Because silos arise from a fundamental human imperative, you know, a universal, if you like, which is that we all need to organize the world into different mental and social boxes just to create some sense of order to get stuff done. But although every design anthropologist have ever studied have silos in the sense of having a classification system, the classification systems are not universal. They vary considerably between different cultures and societies and organizations and professions. So if you have a classification system that isn't working, you can change it.
Jillian Tett, thank you so much. Jillian Tett, she is the U.S. Managing Editor and Columnist at the Financial Times. In 2014, she was named the Columnist of the Year in the British Press Awards. She was also named the Journalist of the Year in 2009. She has a bunch of other awards. Her most recent book, The Silo Effect, The Peril of Expertise and the Promise of Breaking Down Barriers. One of the things, Jillian, that I found difficult about this book was oftentimes when I'm preparing for a podcast, I could read a book very quickly and get the general idea. Yours, however, was far too interesting for me to do that to. The stories are too well written, they're too interesting, and I found myself wanting to really absorb myself in what you had written. And there's a lot of great things to learn from it, but the entertainment element of this book is not to be missed as well. The Silo Effect by Gillian Tett. Gillian, thank you so much for being on the show.
Well, thank you so much for reading so enthusiastically and for having me on the show.
If you enjoyed this episode of the Bregman Leadership Podcast, please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes. For more information about the Bregman Leadership Intensive, as well as access to my articles, videos, and podcasts, visit peterbregman.com. Thank you to Claire Marshall for producing this episode, and to Brian Wood, who created our music. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next great conversation.